Good morning and welcome to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. We live in a world drowning in facts. Between scientific advances and the internet that brings us all this information, it seems like there are more things that we know than ever before. But what does it mean for something to actually be a fact? And what about the reality that things long accepted as facts tend to dissolve into outdated and untrue falsehoods? Today, we're wrapping up our TEDxKC speaker series. All week long, we've been bringing you the voices that were part of Tuesday night's sold-out event at the Kauffman Center. And later this morning, we'll be talking with one of those speakers who thinks that the key to who we are and to unlocking the world might just be found in our eyes. But we begin this morning with another of those speakers, one of Kansas City's own. Samuel Arbisman is a senior scholar at the Kauffman Foundation. He's a mathematician and a network scientist, but you may know his work from The Atlantic or Wired.com. And his new book was also the subject of his TED Talk this week. Sam Arbisman, welcome to you.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much.
So let's start with the title of the book and also of your TED Talk, The Half-Life of Facts. So facts, I guess we generally assume, are just facts. They're true or they aren't. But what's this book about?
So the book is really about how knowledge changes. So we have a lot of facts in our head, whether or not it's facts about our surroundings, about the state of the world, about our current state of knowledge. And oftentimes when we learn them, when we're younger, we assume that they're static. But it turns out lots of things around us change. And on the one hand, that can be a little bit overwhelming, whether or not you learned that dinosaurs used to be cold-blooded and sort of these large reptilian monsters, but in fact they're actually smaller, bird-like, and have feathers.
Right.
Or lots of other different things, even just like the state of the population of the world. And I learned, I think, that there were 5 billion people on the planet in school, and of course we hit 7 billion. But the book is about, even though facts change, that there's an order and a regularity to how these facts change. And by understanding that kind of regularity, in this case in the language of mathematics and science, that can provide a way of ordering our world and the knowledge around us.
Okay, so it seems important that we define what a fact is to have this conversation. When you say a fact, what is a fact?
So in my book, I actually discuss this a little bit, and I pretty much avoid going down some sort of epistemological rabbit hole and saying that a fact is sort of we know when we see it.
Epistemological. We better spell that out. Epistemological is sort of theories of knowledge.
Of knowledge,
right?
Yeah. Okay. So in this case, I don't want to discuss whether or not a fact is a true truth about the world, because oftentimes we have some bit of knowledge in our mind, and it's the current state of science, let's say, and we think it's true, but sometimes it can change. So in this case, I'm using the word fact to mean something that we know, and we have a good reason to think it's true. Whether or not that actually is accurate or not. And of course, along the way, science is asymptotically approaching the truth. We're getting closer and closer to understanding how the world truly works. But along the way, facts are going to be overturned. And so that's the way I end up using fact.
And when you say asymptotically, you mean we're getting closer and closer, but we can't ever quite get there?
I'd like to think we can get there. I don't think we're there yet. We're constantly getting closer. But yes, I would say that and science in general is always in a draft form. And so I think using the idea of an asymptote is a good way of thinking about that.
Okay. Now, this is almost starting to sound philosophical as well as scientific, and I want to talk to you about that as we go along.
Sure.
This morning. I want to continue to flesh out this idea of what a fact is. You mm-hmm. write that there's actually many kinds of facts, and you even coin a term for a particular kind of fact. The word is mesofact, right?
Yes.
What's a mesofact?
So those are the types of facts. Well, if you look at the facts that we learn, the ones we know about, and we say, let's order them on the scale at which they change in terms of how we understand them. So you have facts about the world that could change very rapidly. So for example, the stock market close, we know that that changes on a daily basis, or what the weather is going to be like tomorrow. We're also pretty well adapted to understanding that those kinds of facts are going to change. And on the other end of the scale, you have facts that change really, really rarely, or for all practical purposes, not at all. So it could be the number of continents on the Earth. I mean, that has changed, but it doesn't really change on the order of a decade or two.
Right.
Or the number of fingers on a human hand. You learn that and you're good to go. On the other hand, though, there in between, there are these facts that they can change slowly or on the scale of a human lifetime. But at the same time, we still learn those facts when we're young, and we learn them only once, and we forget to actually mentally update these facts. So going back to dinosaurs, what dinosaurs look like. I was obsessed with dinosaurs when I was little.
Lots of us were.
Yes. So I learned a lot about dinosaurs when I was a little kid, and was pretty surprised to discover that a lot of the things I learned are no longer the state of the art dinosaur knowledge and paleontological knowledge.
So parents who are telling their children what they learned about dinosaurs in their own childhood, even though that has only been 30 years and dinosaurs were millions and millions of years ago, it's wrong now.
Yes. Yes. So there are a lot of things that that we learned that are no longer current knowledge. And so so these facts that change at the middle timescale, or meso is the prefix for that, the facts that change on the order of a human lifetime over years or decades, these facts, we still learn them once and don't really confront them until our children learn something about them as well. It turned out it's a very large portion of our knowledge. So these meso facts they surround us, and we have to learn how to deal with them. And so the book is about those types of facts, but also the regularities behind how facts change, which actually goes to the title of the book, The Half-Life of Facts, which is – I'm using the analogy of in radioactivity. We can't predict when a specific atom of uranium is going to decay. We know how it's going to decay, but it could decay in the next second, or we might have to wait millions and millions of years. But if we look at lots and lots of atoms together, suddenly there are regularities. In this case, we can actually calculate the half-life, how radioactive materials decay over time. And the same thing is true with facts, that even though we can't predict the specific discovery that's going to occur or which fact is going to be overturned, if you combine lots of facts and put them in the aggregate, suddenly there are regularities, how knowledge grows, how it becomes overturned, and even how it decays over time.
I want to bring our listeners into this conversation if their minds have not been completely blown by this already. Can you think of some meso facts in your own life or your own world, things that have been accepted as facts maybe when you were a kid but which now aren't seen that way any longer? Give us a call at 816-235-2888, 235-2888, or email us at updatedate@kcur.org. Share with us your thoughts about the half-life of facts. We're talking with Sam Arbisman, who's written a book by that title and was one of the TEDxKC speakers this week. So, Sam, give us you say that you can actually predict on a certain basis the way that these facts will decay, if you will, that they will no longer be facts. Is it a mathematical formula? Can you give me a number? Like, on average, how many years will a fact last? Is it that kind of calculation?
In some areas, you actually can do that. It of course depends on the field. So some fields change more rapidly than others. So for example, in math, once you've proved a theorem to your satisfaction, it's true and you're done. On the other hand, though, medicine actually has a great deal of knowledge that overturns fairly rapidly. So about 10 years ago, a team of scientists in France actually set out to measure how knowledge becomes overturned in two fields related to liver disease, hepatitis and cirrhosis. And what they did was they gave a series of papers from over a span of 50 years to a panel of experts. And they said, categorize each paper as still true or out of date or otherwise been overturned. And they were able to actually draw a curve of the decay over time. And from that, they were able to realize that every 45 years, half of the knowledge in these two medical fields actually becomes overturned or is otherwise rendered obsolete.
And
every 45 years.
Every 45 years. 45 I'm
years.
Sorry, I may have missed.
Yeah, so every 45 years, and I think that's an overly strict criterion. There are lots of other things that are not necessarily out of date, but are sometimes obsolete. And so I know in medical schools, students are now taught that a large fraction of what they learn is going to be obsolete probably within a few years of their graduation. And so in medical schools and medicine in general has begun to incorporate this into how they teach and how they learn, where there's continuing medical education, there's online services that provide constantly up-to-date knowledge. But by and large, it's a lot of things do become overturned, but you can measure that. And more generally within science, you can look at how often a paper is cited to see as a measure of its currency. So some papers are really influential and sometimes just stop getting cited because they're so important. But a lot of papers, and the vast majority of them, stop getting cited because they're no longer current or they're just wrong. And you can actually look at the half-life of the decay of citations, of like one paper referring to another paper, and you can see that takes maybe 7 years for papers to receive half the number of citations that they used to. And you can actually compare different areas quite easily and see that sometimes in the natural sciences there's a bit longer half-life than in the social sciences, although it depends if you're looking at paper level versus textbooks. And so there's all different ways of actually quantifying this kind of thing.
Right. And you started to talk about why any of this matters essentially. Mm-hmm. So in the medical world, it's fairly obvious why it matters, right? If one fact no longer being a fact means people are going to be unhealthier as a result of the decisions we make, then obviously we need to update our understanding of the facts. Why is this important for sort of a more ethereal sort of knowledge, the way the world was evolved into being or whatever.
So I would say there's a couple different ways of thinking about it. So on the one hand, there's just this idea that and we all have lots of facts in our head. And when we see that a lot of facts are being overturned, it can be a little overwhelming or worrying or cause a certain amount of anxiety. But if we know how facts change, then that can actually provide a sense of order to how knowledge changes in general, and so can stop being overwhelming. But in terms of just ethereal knowledge or kind of more fundamental science, science is fundamentally cumulative, and you have to build things on a foundation of what came before. And so therefore, if you're not able to recognize that a lot of what came before you is no longer true, then you're not able to truly be cumulative and make science the cumulative endeavor it really is.
We have a lot of interest from our listeners in the half-life of facts. We're talking with Sam Arbisman here on Up to Date on KCUR. Let's go first to Lisa. She called us at 816-235-2888. Lisa, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for this conversation. It's really great. What I hear you articulating is a conundrum that parents have to deal with all the time, and I feel it in raising my kids. Facts that my parents gave me about parenting and about, you know, how to be with, you know, discipline a kid that now I grow up and I'm like, that's not true at all. And for the one that I'm thinking of in particular is, you know, don't go swimming 30 minutes after you eat or you will get a cramp. Okay, so, I grew up thinking, okay, well, don't ever do that. Don't ever do that. You're going to, and now as an adult, I'm like, well, that's not true at all. I mean, you can go swimming and eat and, you know, by the pool and whatever. So it sort of has made the switch from fact to maybe some sort of wisdom. Maybe there was some sort of wisdom in that they just didn't want to deal with kids after swimming and they wanted them to take a break or something like that. And so the switch from truth to wisdom. And I'm also thinking about this whenever I teach about the Bible, when I teach about scripture and stuff, I make a distinction between that which is truth and that which is factual. I always teach that the Bible is true, but not always factual. And so I'm loving this distinction between those two things. And so I just wanted to throw that out there, that this is it's a conundrum that parents face all the time.
Thanks, Lisa, so much. That's a great comment. I do wonder about the things like don't swim for 30 minutes after you eat, which this isn't a very inclusive term, but an old wives' tale that we sometimes call those sorts of things. But old wives' tales once were regarded as facts, right?
Oh, certainly. And I think some of them do have a certain element of truth to them. But for a lot of people, we learn these things when we're young or we're raised in a certain way, and then we often think that's the way things should be. And it certainly in terms of parenting techniques or how we raise children, there is a lot of flux. And I think it's good to just at least be aware of that. And so whether or not babies should sleep on their stomachs or their backs. Someone was telling me that apparently his mother was actually encouraged to smoke while she was pregnant with him, which we no longer think is a good idea.
Encouraged to smoke.
Yeah, encouraged. And so I think there's that might have been an outlier. But there's a lot of knowledge that changes. And that being said, though, I want to just clarify that even though facts do change, there's often – we have to make a distinction between facts changing sort of the frontier of knowledge versus the core of what we know. So there, mm-hmm. there are some things that – so for example, that DNA is the genetic material. That's probably not going to change. We might learn new things about that. But at the same time though, that's very different than the things that are in the current scientific journals where we're still – we're at the frontier. We're trying to really understand things. And I think a lot of – practices related to child rearing, some of those things are at the frontier. We have a pretty good idea of really, really bad ways to raise children, and we're going to avoid those things. But at the frontier, sort of at the edges, we're still trying to work things out. And I think those are the areas where we have to at least be cognizant of facts changing and the being a certain amount of flux.
Chris in Lenexa, thanks for calling in.
Hi. I wanted to ask about pushback from the public when experts decide that the fact has changed. Specifically, the incident I'm thinking of is when the astronomers 5 or 6 years ago demoted Pluto from a planet. You know, astronomers can tell me that Pluto's not a planet, but as far as I'm concerned, it is. it's like, who are they to say that it's not, What kind of research has been done on something like that?
So I don't know how much research has been done on Pluto's demotion and pushback from the public. I do know that whether or not we think Pluto is a planet, it's probably not going to affect you in your daily life. So either one is probably okay. I definitely know that there's a large segment of the population that is unhappy with a demotion. When it comes to things, though, that
and why are they unhappy?
I think one of the reasons people are unhappy is because they learned it during their childhood, and that's the time when you absorb a lot of information. And so it's very distressing to think, well, everything I learned is wrong. Pluto, this lovable little planet on the outskirts of the solar system, is no longer a planet. But it turns out this is actually not the first time this has happened. In the 1800s, when the first asteroid was discovered, it was so large that people actually thought it was a planet. And then they discovered three more asteroids that were much larger than the rest of the asteroid belt. They were all given planetary names. Decades of school children learned that these were planets until they discovered that there were actually a large number of asteroids in between Mars and Jupiter, and there's a whole asteroid belt. Those planets then became demoted, and I imagine there might have been a similar amount of pushback for the children who learned it during that time period.
So are the implications then of what you're saying that we ought to teach kids that facts sometimes change, that yes,
exactly.
I'm about to teach you the nine planets in order, and here's a little rhyme to remember them. But be aware that you may have to change this rhyme in 20 years because we may find more planets or decide that these aren't planets after all.
I think that's actually a really good idea. And we should certainly say that you should make decisions based on the best knowledge we have. But if you are aware that knowledge can change, you shouldn't be surprised. By understanding how knowledge changes and the regularities behind it, it can place a certain amount of bounds to our surprise. And so if we were taught that Pluto's a planet, but we might want to re-examine it. And so I can actually remember as a kid also, in addition to being obsessed with dinosaurs, I also loved outer space. I learned about Pluto, and people were beginning to notice that Pluto didn't really fit the other planets. And so there was a certain amount of anxiety about its place. And I think if people can be taught that at a young enough age, that facts can change, that'll it'll be better for everyone.
Bill, north of the river, is calling in. You have one of these half-life facts, right?
Right. Yeah. I'm 63. When I was in grade school, and I mean like third or fourth grade, in geography class, we'd have a globe out, and we would point out the fact that it looked like the continents at one time joined together. You know, they kind of fit like a puzzle, and invariably we would be told that, you know, stick to the subject matter, and that, you know, that's impossible. The next thing that I can recall was, there's another great example. When I was young, and I, at the same time frame, 5, 6, 7 in there, see these smokestacks going off, and I'd ask my parents, I'd go, you know, where does that smoke go? And they'd just go, it just disappears. And I always thought, I guess from a child, the way of looking at things, it was like, well, that's not going to disappear. I mean, that's a big mark in the sky. Those are two examples I can think of.
Thanks for the call, Bill. Sammy actually emailed us at uptodate@kcur.org, said, remember taste buds, how when we were in school, they used to tell us that different parts of the tongue had different types of sensations associated with them. Turns out it's totally bunk, and all taste buds are created equal. I only learned this when my kid told me about it. Mm-hmm. Another good example.
That's great.
And then there's Gloria in Fairway. Gloria, good morning.
Hi. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. What's your example of facts changing in your life?
Well, I went to my doctor, and she told me that my symptoms were in my head. And so for 15 years, I lived with fibromyalgia undiagnosed, and it's a very painful connective tissue disorder. And so when it was diagnosed, I was greatly relieved, and I told her, and she still didn't believe in it.
So another case of medical diagnoses and facts changing over time.
Right, right. And people not willing to change their minds about change.
Gloria, thank you so much for the call.
You're welcome.
Now, I want to take one more call here from Jerry in Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Was that Gary you're looking for?
I'm sorry. I just didn't know how it was pronounced. Yes, Gary.
Yes, Gary.
Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning. I think this is a very interesting discussion about how facts change over time, and definitely scientific beliefs evolve. And for most people, science is difficult, and people don't like difficult things. People resist things that are not easily mastered. And I think that people are prone to fall back on their faith-based beliefs, even if they're factually refutable. And a great recent example we've had is Todd Eakin here in Missouri, and he's made statements that have confused a normal female sexual arousal response with susceptibility to pregnancy.
Okay.
He's completely misstated the facts.
Okay, Gary. Well, hold on. Let me ask our guest to comment on how – are you talking about the uses of facts for various purposes? Do you think sometimes there's a difference between facts being misunderstood versus accepted as facts broadly?
Yeah, and so certainly there is a difference, and I think there's a difference between misunderstanding a fact and or maybe the scientific establishment, learning something new or I guess discovering a new idea which can kind of overturn something older, and also adhering to outdated knowledge. So just because there's some new scientific discovery doesn't necessarily mean that everyone has that newest bit of information in their heads. Sometimes there can even be a certain amount of recalcitrance and actually just desiring to not adhere to the newest information. And this is nothing new. Back when there was a certain theory of disease called the miasma theory of disease, when people thought that low-lying clouds actually carried disease, physicians thought nothing of performing autopsies and then delivering babies. And then this one physician, Ignaz Semmelweis, said maybe we should wash our hands or clean our hands. And he was ridiculed. And we now know that the germ theory is correct. And so I think there is a certain amount of pushback that knowledge change can have. And so we have to always be aware of that.
Before we let you go, Sam Arbusman, I want to just talk briefly about what you do. You are a senior scholar here at the Ewing Marion Kauffman Foundation in Kansas City. What do you do all day?
Well, a whole variety of things. I mainly do research into using math and computer science to understand how our interactions affect our productivity, innovation, trying to understand the science of science, actually quantifying how scientific discovery occurs, and also trying to understand why certain cities are more productive than others, why certain cities grow and die, pretty much just trying to take an applied mathematical approach to interactions and social structures in general and just really trying to understand the world.
Very good. Sam Arbusman is a senior scholar at the Kauffman Foundation. He spoke at this week's TEDxKC conference about the theme of his new book, The Half-Life of Facts. It comes out next month. Sam, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you so much.